You know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Chen Dinachi, past Shinshinia on Two Jewish, a young representative of Israel joining us this morning from Israel, discussing her experiences during the recent Gaza War. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. The 2021 version of the Gaza War ended last weekend with a ceasefire that brought an end to the latest chapter in this ongoing conflict between the Hamas terrorists and Israel. Thank God it seems to really be over now, thanks in large part to mediation by Egypt with some pushing from the United States. There's never really a winner in these battles, but there are always losers, and it's worth tabulating just who they were. First, the greatest losers are, as always, the Palestinians living in Gaza. Their brutal autocratic leadership, the extremist Islamists of Hamas, brought general destruction to the infrastructure that supports the lives of 2 million people. In addition to over 200 deaths, some of them Hamas terrorists, but many of them civilians, their rain of rockets on Israeli civilians pushed the IDF to destroy buildings, power grids, streets, businesses, even water supplies. Hamas's own tunnels beneath Gaza, designed to reach Israel so that terrorist murders can be perpetrated, and designed to be used for rocket manufacturing and protect their warriors, were largely destroyed, or at least that's what the Israeli military says. Palestinians are now unofficially much farther from having a real state than they were even 2 weeks ago, if that's possible. And their lives in Gaza are more miserable still. It's a terrible situation that, as usual, Palestinian leadership has chosen to make much worse. Again, this whole miserable Gaza scenario this time around was precipitated by Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, the permanent president of Palestine, or at least of the West Bank, when he called off elections originally scheduled to take place last week. Instead of putting pressure on Abbas to call elections, the Gaza War has relieved that pressure almost entirely. How can you call for elections when things are so unsettled now and there's a humanitarian crisis among Palestinians in Gaza, right? It must be added that Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu was finally on the precipice of losing office for the first time in 12 years before Hamas started shooting rockets at Israeli children. And so, by committing repeated war crimes and attacking Israeli civilians and getting stomped in response, Hamas has both given Abbas cover for his refusal to hold elections that might have brought Hamas to power in the West Bank, and also preserved Netanyahu in office for at least another year or so. I guess if your only goal is the total destruction of Israel, the only Jewish state, that's Hamas's stated purpose, any positive gains for your own people are, of course, irrelevant. And putting the region on track for a potential two-state solution is worse than a failure. It's a betrayal of those principles. And so, once again, Palestinians have chosen to opt for colorful destruction, mostly of their own people, over a course of action that would actually put their people in a better situation and might really lead to an actual nation of Palestine. There are many other losers from this 11-day war. Normal Israeli citizens, you'll hear from one of them this morning, Chen Dinachi, a past Shinshinia, young representative of Israel here in Tucson, in just a few moments. Normal Israeli citizens were forced into bomb shelters and traumatized. 10 of them died, including children, and others were terrified when Arab street riots broke out in previously peaceful towns, where Jews and Arabs had lived together for generations. Citizens of Central Israel got a taste of what their countrymen and women had been experiencing in the South and that area of Israel for years, and they hated it. With Palestinian terrorist rockets falling on homes, cars, and businesses. And of course, Jews around the world and around the United States were also losers. There have been anti-Semitic attacks, including beatings, arson, people being burned, and criminal destruction perpetrated by Arabs and Arab sympathizers and anti-Semites all over the world. Perpetrated on synagogues, in restaurants, on the street. Free Palestine and F the Jews are the new slogans of hate crime perpetrators in New York, Los Angeles, Tucson, Europe, London, and many other places. Israel lost the PR battle in this Gaza war as totally as it ever has, and that includes among American progressives. I have to note that at this point, the facts don't really matter. Truth is another loser in this war. It's certainly true that Israel spends its national effort and treasure to protect its citizens with the Iron Dome systems and a huge network of bomb shelters for every building. Hamas spends its internationally donated funds on rockets and Iranian missiles in an attempt to murder Jews, and in tunnels to protect its soldiers, while it tries to get its own people killed so there can be more martyrs for the international media and for social media to focus on. Those tragically dead Arab children in Gaza, it's awful. They would be alive if their own brutal, theocratic Hamas dictators had not deliberately forced Israel to respond to 5,000 rocket attacks aimed at Jewish children. It's also fascinating to see Israel accused of war crimes for disproportionate use of force. Hamas's entire approach through this period has been one war crime after another, aiming almost entirely at civilian populations with its weapons. Israel has sought to intercept Hamas's weaponry and destroy its military capacity. They've even warned in advance of many of their attacks. By the way, nobody seems to be going to the UN about Syria's always burgeoning war crimes, still being perpetrated against its own citizens in ethnic cleansing orgies, or the war crimes our own U.S. military might have committed targeting civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan, or Russia's war crimes in Ukraine, or China's war crimes in its genocide of the Uyghur Muslim minority, or Myanmar's war crimes against its Muslim Rohingya citizens, well, and of course, against journalists. Only Israel is the focus for defending itself for 11 days after being attacked. Imagine if a whole bunch of rockets were shot from Tijuana into San Diego, or from Nogales, Sonora into Nogales, Arizona, or from Juarez into El Paso. How long would it take before the U.S. military responded in great force? Another loser in this. Once again, I'm afraid the Israeli political system is a loser because the government that was within hours of being formed with a new prime minister was called off due to the emergency of war, bitachon. And now there's likely to be yet another election and more time with Bibi Netanyahu as prime minister on trial for corruption forever. Amidst all these losses, however, I do have one suggestion for both Israel and America's Jews, and maybe in the longer run we can use this to turn loss into some kind of gain. My current suggestion is this. The progressive movement in America, which has been catalyzed by a Jewish guy, Bernie Sanders, and which has captivated so many young people, has chosen to equate every inequity in American society with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's a mark of just how spectacularly ignorant of the realities of the Middle East most of those involved with the progressive movement are, and how easy it is for them to lapse into comparing every other situation in the world to America, the only place most of them have any real knowledge of as a point of reference. Hamas is not George Floyd. Palestinian terrorists are not men or women of color in Chicago or New York or Los Angeles or Minneapolis or Ferguson, Missouri or Louisville, Kentucky. Israel is not South Africa in the 1970s, and no one on the Palestinian side of this conflict is much like Nelson Mandela. Equating unequal things doesn't demonstrate anything but ignorance. But I have always contended that ignorance is not bigotry. It may lead to that. The complete lack of a deeper understanding of Israel and the complexity of the Palestinians' own Soros among the progressive movement leaders, including leading lights like Bernie Sanders or Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, well, that's actually an opportunity. And it's important that we not miss that opportunity in our appropriately righteous indignation. I am old enough to remember a time, maybe 30 years ago, when American Jews and Israelis considered evangelical Christians to be dangerous fanatics, dedicated to converting all Jews to the belief in Jesus. Evangelicals were thought to be anti-Semites, part of the long Christian history of persecuting Jews, forcing conversions, depriving us of rights, killing us, and nobody considered evangelicals likely to be supporters of Israel. Evangelical Christians in those days, not that long ago, were lumped by most Jews with the KKK and the Aryan Nation. And yet, a variety of innovative Jews believed that outreach to evangelicals could prove valuable, in spite of their desire to, you know, convert us to Christianity. And over time, and with careful outreach by pro-Israel organizations, not shouting, not demonizing, but inviting them to see what Israel really is like, how Jews really believe and behave and think. Well, the American evangelical communities become quite likely the strongest supporters of Israel in the world. Nowadays, whenever Israel's attacked, it's the evangelical Christians who are first to defend her. That did not happen by accident. And it didn't happen because we stayed in our bunkers, or bomb shelters, and worried that evangelicals only liked us because Jesus had to go to Israel for the second coming. It happened because we found appropriate common ground and built upon it. So, why can't a serious outreach to the progressive movement, based on showing its leaders and the members of that movement that Israel is by far the most progressive nation in the Middle East, why can't that prove effective? Isn't it possible that we could show American progressives that Tel Aviv is very likely the most progressive city in the whole Mediterranean basin, that Israel's healthcare system and welfare systems are far more egalitarian and advanced than America's, that everybody in Israel has Wi-Fi and access to technology in a way that many Americans can only dream of? Wouldn't it be better to teach leaders of BLM that Israel is a multicultural, multi-ethnic society under the rule of law, in which Israelis of every skin, color, and background live next to each other in a highly productive, peaceful nation? Might we not persuade people better by showing them the real nature of the only Jewish nation on earth, including its substantial black populations, rather than by shouting at them? Look, it's way easier for us to shout. Me too. I am far from the most conservative person in the world, but I find that a progressive movement that prefers the Islamist terrorist anti-Semites to the only modern democratic nation in the entire region, well, I find that inexplicably dumb. But Palestine among progressives right now is cool. Israel is not. Isn't the better approach to seek to change that through education and appeal, rather than do what I kind of did earlier today and just rail against it? And you know, what's happening now isn't working. Maybe reaching out and educating and sharing what's really going on, maybe that could actually work. Play us in this morning. Here's a Jewish-Arab shared song of peace in Hebrew and Arabic, Shalom Aleinu, from around the time of the first Gaza War, way back in 2007.
Oh, لو يبقى عيدي إيمانك وأحلام لما تتطفى كل الناس بيبقوها
نصير عيلة حب عيلة تشرب من كاس
من كاس السلام من كاس السلام كاس السلام معنا أجمل من السلام معنا أجمل من السلام معنا أجمل من السلام
That was Shalom Aleinu, peace be upon all of us. May that come true soon. And it might just require divine intervention. When we return on Two Jewish in a Moment, our guest, Chen Denachi, a past Shin Shinia, a young representative of Israel, we had the privilege of listening to here on Two Jewish for a year, joins us from Israel, sharing stories about her experiences during the recent Gaza War. Hear about those when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills and northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, west of La Cholla, in its own building near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person. I know, that's exciting to hear about. Friday night and Saturday morning. Friday night at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m., and services are at 10 a.m. Or if you prefer, you can join us every Friday night on our Facebook page. Again, Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m. All with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A Tucson. We will continue to hold our services both live with full attendance now, and if you're vaccinated, no mask, and by virtual experience. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are both live and on Zoom. You can access those by emailing me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A. Our wonderful religious school will be available starting again the beginning of August in blended formats, both live and on Zoom. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to come to services in person or, you know, online, for our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs. Just had our first confirmation. It was great fun. Rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught on Zoom and in person. And, of course, all of our services on Facebook. Go to beitsimchatucson.org, beitsimchatucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community and the fastest growing synagogue in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our longtime Shinshinia. Is that correct? I always mess that word up. Our young representative on Israel, Chen Denachi, speaking from Israel. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me. I miss being here. Talking.
So tell us a little bit about what you're doing right now, just so everybody can catch up on your life.
Oh, well, I'm actually applying to dentist school, and I have a very big test in 2 days. That, in full disclosure, I'm probably not going to pass. So please pray for me. Thank you.
I'm a rabbi. I'm trained to do that. I will do that for sure. Chen, in the recent conflict with Gaza, tell us what happened to you, where you were, what was going on with you and with your life.
So I was studying, which obviously stopped because who can study? I was home and my town was being bombed pretty regularly. Obviously, it was just a taste for me because I'm not part of the region in Israel that's close to Gaza, and they get very regularly bombed. Like, it's not even a big deal anymore, which is sad. But this time, more central areas got a taste of how they live, which was very bitter, I must say. It was really bad, and it was super scary. I think it's really hard to imagine a situation where you stay up so you don't miss an alarm, a siren, if it accidentally goes off. And I had to wake my parents up 5 times a night and run them to the shelter. And in my case, actually, we were in my neighbor's shelter, and there they have a tenant that lives in an apartment under their house. So we were all, so this big religious family, 5 small kids, their tenant, his girlfriend, and my family. And we're all stuffed in this tiny little room. And we meet at the weirdest times because you don't know when it's going to go off. So 5 a.m., 6 p.m., someone's getting out of the shower. You just run. All the dogs, all the cats, everyone in the same tiny little room. Everyone brings something that they care about that they don't want to get lost if the house is bombed. So yeah, it was really interesting. It was terrible. And I specifically was terrified also because a lot of people very close to me were doing very scary things in the military. As you know, I'm in that age where a lot of my close friends and family are in the military. I also told you before, my boyfriend is in a very special unit, and I can't really say more, but I was terrified the entire time. So it's really a scary and crazy reality that I think is really hard to comprehend if you don't experience it. I know, because this was my first time truly experiencing regular sirens during an entire operation, war, I don't know what we call it, but it was awful. And I really hope that somehow it's not going to happen again. But also, I'm very happy that the center of Israel got a bit of bomb so that we know what the south is going through all the time.
And has been going through for a long time. Chen, just real briefly, tell us where you live.
So I live in a small town named Shoham. It's between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. It's close to the airport, which they were trying to bomb.
Right, they were trying to hit Ben Gurion.
It was really fun.
So we'll talk much more when we come back in a minute with Chen Donachi from Israel here on Two Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18 at Gmail, or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
One of your favorite places in the world is one of the more interesting islands in the world, off the southern tip of Italy, kind of in the middle of the Mediterranean, Sicily. I wasn't aware that it had an important Jewish history, but it certainly has a lot of history.
It has a lot of history, and it has a lot of Jewish history, and it's one of those small unexpected corners of the Jewish world where Jewish life is undergoing an active and dramatic rebirth. So yeah, let's talk about Sicily. Among other things, it has probably the best food in Europe at this time of year in this season.
Wow.
It's unbelievable.
That's a lot of competition. The
right,
best food
right,
in Europe.
Right. Well, it depends on what month you're talking about. But in May, nothing beats Sicily. So Sicily, for much of antiquity, was known as Magna Graecia, which is Latin for Greater Greece. And it was largely a Greek-speaking island. And for about 300 years, the biggest city in the Greek-speaking world was Syracuse, which is in Sicily.
Syracuse.
Right. And many people know that Sicily has more Greek temples, amphitheaters, etc., like major intact beautiful Greek ruins than Greece itself, and they're better preserved. So one of the things that's hard to describe about Sicily for most American listeners is that people think Sicily, it's part of Italy. They think of the Godfather. They think of Italian-Americans.
Sicilian mafia.
Right.
Right.
Okay. But there was no Italy until 1871. So Sicilians never thought of themselves as Italians. I mean, historically, they were ruled by Phoenicians, by Greeks, by Romans, the Roman Republic, then the Roman Empire, then by the Byzantine Empire from Constantinople, then by Arabs, then by Normans, and
Norman pirates, actually, kind of.
Well, they were mercenaries.
Were Vikings, really, right?
Normans are definitely descended from the Vikings, and they were originally brought in by Southern Italian aristocrats to quash disorder. They were mercenaries. And then they invaded Sicily and freed it from the Muslims early in the 11th century. And certain historians would argue that really that was the beginning of the Crusades, not the First Crusade, the Second Crusade that we know about that were decreed by popes, but this chasing out of Muslims from a land in the middle of Christendom, literally in the geographic heart, and the biggest island in the Mediterranean. So at certain points in time, Sicily was incredibly prosperous. It was not a basket case economically. It didn't export labor. It imported labor. And then the list of conquerors goes on, because there were several Spanish dynasties. There was a German dynasty. There was a French dynasty. It bounced back and forth, but for many hundreds of years, it was effectively ruled by Spain.
Very
complicated history. And I guess we'll get to the Jewish part of Sicily next week. Thanks so much, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. You know, being half Jewish can be very confusing, especially if you are a child from a mixed marriage. I have a friend. He's half Jewish, half Japanese. Every December 7th, he attacks Pearl Schwartz. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. On behalf of that joke, I apologize to all of our Japanese listeners. And also our Jewish ones. Maybe everyone else, too. And now a word of Torah. This week we chant the dramatic portion of Shlach Lecha in the book of Numbers, the story of the Meraglim, the spies. The Israelites have journeyed to the borders of the Holy Land just a year and a half after leaving Egyptian exile. Under God's direction, Moses sends 12 spies, one from each tribe, princes of the people, wealthy men of standing, into the land of Canaan to scout the land, see if it can be captured. The spies take a month to tour the whole land. They report back to Moses, Canaan is very good, flowing with milk and honey. They even bring back a huge cluster of grapes, so large it must be carried by two men on a pole. Now the enduring symbol of Israel's tourism ministry. Everything's going to be great. But it's not. 10 of the 12 spies proceed to report that the people of the land are huge. We felt like grasshoppers next to them, they say, and numerous. The cities are fortified and unassailable. The Israelites have no chance to capture Canaan in spite of having God's support. It's hopeless. Two spies, Caleb and Joshua, deliver a minority report, saying that with God's help, the land can be taken, but the people are terrified. Again, they ask Moses and Aaron, why did you take us from slavery just to kill us here at the hands of our enemies? Well, at this point, God decides this generation of former slaves will never be able to become a free people in its own land. The psychological shackles of slavery are too strong to overthrow in just one generation. They must remain in the Sinai wilderness until the adults all die off, and a new generation arises that has not known slavery and its defeatist mentality. Stung by the verdict, the people turn again and attempt a leaderless invasion of the land without God's support. It fails dismally, and the people of Israel are now condemned to wander the wilderness for 38 more years, a total of 40 since they left Egyptian slavery, until a new young generation can emerge to take the reins and enter the land with a fresh perspective, having been born into freedom. It's a great lesson in the process that's required to cleanse the trauma of failure from the minds of a community. Often it's not one single act or great revolution that truly remakes a people, country, or an organization. It's the generational turn that comes from learning things can be done differently and better, that freedom is a birthright to be defended. In our own lives, we Jews today often share our ancestors' tendency to believe failure is permanent and success temporary. But Shlach Lecha shows the danger of such belief and the importance of having faith in God and in our own ability to change for the better. When we come back, Chen Denachi, a past Shin Shinia, a young representative of Israel who was here regularly on Too Jewish for a year, joins us from Israel, sharing stories about her own experience during the recent Gaza war. Hear all about it when we come back here on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
If we wanted to this morning, our whole news segment could focus on the anti-Semitic attacks that took place and continue to take place all around the world in the aftermath of the Gaza war. In Europe, of course, we've come to expect this, and we got it, in Berlin, Madrid, Paris, Austria, Ukraine, Great Britain, and elsewhere. But this time round, we also had anti-Semitic attacks, including street fighting, in New York,
attacks on restaurants in Los Angeles, synagogue attack in Tucson, and in many other places. In response, President Joe Biden said the recent attacks on the Jewish community are despicable, and they must stop. In international responses to the Gaza war, the Irish parliament passed a non-binding resolution saying Israel has annexed the West Bank, which Israel denies, while France's foreign minister stated that Israel has a high risk of apartheid by maintaining the status quo in the territories or enforcing a one-state solution. Prime Minister Netanyahu responded harshly. And the UN, you can always rely on the UN to be virulently anti-Israel, of course. They last week voted to establish a permanent probe into Israeli human rights abuses. At the risk of stating the blindingly obvious, horrific human rights abuses around the world routinely go ignored by the United Nations. In Myanmar, in China, in Syria, in Yemen, in Jordan, in Saudi Arabia, in Russia, in Belarus, in Ukraine, in Turkey, in the Philippines, in Malaysia, Venezuela, Sudan, etc., etc., etc. That is, all the least free and most brutal places in the world. But Israel, a liberal democracy with a free press and the rule of law, somehow merits a permanent body scrutinizing its human rights record. We are hoping to have more upbeat news for you next week, God willing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our very special guest, Chen Denachi, who is one of the Shin Shinim, representing the young representatives of Israel here in America for a year, and is now back in Shoham in central Israel, kind of in the heart of things between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. We were talking about her experience during the Gaza War. Is this the first time in your experience that you've had to head into the shelter in the time of war?
So actually, a lot, I think, most people in Israel have experienced going to the shelter before, but this was the first time we had a substantial amount of bombs, rockets, sirens. Like, this was war. It wasn't like a one-time thing, because in the last two operations, they have aimed a missile to where I lived before, but it was like one. And this time, it was just an insane amount, and it was really scary, and it was everywhere in Israel. I don't know someone who didn't go to the shelter during this entire thing.
So you are in an age cohort where you are online all the time. I mean, we all are nowadays, but tell us, as an Israeli, as a young Israeli, what your experience of that was during the Gaza fighting and now.
I think this is the most important question for me, because this time felt very different. I think that this new social media age is very important, because it gives us a way to distribute information very easily. But you also got to be careful, because when information is distributed very easily by anyone and everyone, a lot of misleading information can be out there. And I think that I really could feel the ignorance of people on social media. Now, it's not their fault. When I say ignorance, it has a very negative tone to it, which it does, but I understand that it's very hard to grasp a 70-something-year-old conflict when you live in a country that's so established and has no existential fear. I think that a lot of people also forget that their countries took land, and their countries did war crimes, even though I don't believe that the IDF does war crimes. I do believe that it's one of the most moral militaries in the world. And I think that a lot of times people forget what extremism is, and they forget that it's not necessarily another government that you can talk to. And it's also not a government that cares and protects its citizens. The people of Gaza, the civilians there, my heart breaks for them, genuinely. I'm not the type of person to ever be happy about anyone dying. I think that people online and around the world, and especially I've been seeing it with American teenagers, so this is a great way to really spread out what I have to say, because mostly American teenagers and just youngsters, Hamas is a terrorist organization who terrorizes their people. They get no freedom. They are an autonomous territory run by Hamas. And I know that the Free Palestine movement has linked itself to other positive movements like BLM. Obviously, racism is terrible. But you have to understand as people that racism and judging someone or like depriving them of basic human rights based on their skin color is very, very different from two autonomous territories fighting over land. So when a lot of these movements kind of say, if you support us, you support Free Palestine, they're misusing their power. They are abusing their power, and you should really be mindful to what you're blindly supporting, because not everyone that you trust is trustworthy, especially if you get this information online. And, you know, there was a whole thing about Gigi and Bella and Kendall. And I was mad, obviously, but I also asked myself, since when do 24-year-old models who never stepped foot in the Middle East are considered a reliable news source? Why are we even listening to them? They can say whatever they want, but why are we giving it so much power, you know?
I wondered myself, of course, for those of us who are older and aren't watching TikTokers or whomever criticizing Israel, then we see comedians on late night TV doing rants about how terrible Israel is, and what exactly qualifies them to be political commentators on the Middle East. It's the same kind of feeling at a variety of ages. But look, you aren't out there doing public relations for Israel. But what do you think Israel could do to explain itself better to the world? Is there a way?
Obviously, what I did in Tucson was a part of that mission. And I got to say that I was very disappointed in a lot of people that I worked with in the community, because a lot of them turned their backs on Israel because it's not the popular opinion. It's controversial right now to support Israel, which is absurd in my eyes. But I, to be very honest with you, I lost hope a bit. I think that there's just, the Muslim world is so big and the Jewish world is so small. I just don't know what to do. I think that mostly just pushing people to read and really look into what they're saying and really like get your information from someone who studied the Middle East. They can be Muslim. They can be Christian. They don't need to be Jewish Israeli, but get like fact-supported information. I think education is the most important thing, because we're fighting ignorance, essentially. I mean, anyone who has a very wide understanding of this conflict will tell you that Hamas is harming both Israel and its own people. So if you're trying to support Palestinian lives, you definitely don't want to support Hamas, who right now controls them, who also gets all the money that you're sending them. So in my opinion, it's just about knowledge. And on that note, I want to recommend two Google searches for anyone like thinking about the conflict right now. So the first one is going to be someone named Musab Hussein Youssef, but I'm going to say it in a Googleable way. Musab Hussein Youssef. He was the son of the head of Hamas, and he grew up in Ramallah as a terrorist, basically, as an active terrorist of Hamas. And he became one of Israel's top agents in the Shabak. I have no idea how to say it in English.
No, that's the Israeli Secret Service that works in the territories. If you've ever seen Fauda, you get some idea.
Yes. So he definitely knows both worlds from the inside. And he has a really interesting book called Son of Hamas, which I really recommend reading. And he's now on the UN Watch, and he has a lot of interesting things to say. I think he's very insightful, and he obviously is the person who knows most about both of the cores of this conflict. So I really recommend the book. And also, I've been seeing a lot of accusations that are just baseless, like Israel is doing an ethnic cleansing or all kinds of things, like accusations about racism. I've seen like people say, nothing is complicated about this. Brown kids are dying. Like, girl, this is the Middle East. We all brown.
Yeah, I always wonder about that. I think Israelis are sometimes darker than Palestinians pretty commonly. It's not about skin color.
My grandma is Moroccan and my grandpa is Egyptian.
Go
so
ahead,
I
I'm sorry.
I also recommend looking up different communities in Israel that are not Jewish. For example, the Druze. I really recommend people looking up Druze people because they're not very known, but they're a big part of our society. They have their own religion that is secretive. They speak Arabic. They have uniform, kind of like a hijab, but a bit different. And yet they live in harmony, peace. They thrive. They're doctors. They have key positions in the military. They are top-tier people in our society, and they are not Jewish, and they don't look Jewish, and they speak Arabic. So it's just one example of how Israeli society includes. It's not, no one cares if you're Jewish or not. People love Jewish people. I don't know one person who would tell you they don't like Jewish people because they do their part. So why would anyone not like them? They're not violent and they thrive. They're the best doctors we have are Jews. So yeah, it's not about ethnic cleansing, you guys.
Yeah, and I have another question. You're not too far from Lod, where there was some really terrible rioting. Can you tell us, like, your perception of that?
A lot of my friends live there, and I used to be a scout counselor in Lod because their scout tribe, also don't judge me if you're hearing this, scouts in Israel are cool.
Well, you got to be cool. I mean, cool matters. I understand. Keep going.
Anyway, so their tribe thingy needed counselors because no one was doing that there. So I volunteered and I actually met a lot of Arabic kids who were Arabs who live in Lod, and I was their counselor. And now I saw them like a part of really bad things and like putting up flags and burning Israeli flags. And I'm like, this is crazy because you guys were such good kids and you like had such good futures. Like why refer to violence? And so many people that I know and love live in Lod, Arabs and Israelis, and have been experiencing horror. Now it's really important to understand that this violence also stems from ignorance. Because there are a lot of Arabs who didn't participate in it. There are a lot of Arabs who just want to live in peace. But if you really take a good look into these violent protests, and I'm saying like people died, people were killed. It's usually young people who are not as educated and are just kind of lost in life. You don't really see them in universities. You don't see them in school. You don't see them working. And again, I think ignorance is our biggest problem, and education will solve everything. Because I personally study in university. There's an example for you guys. My class in college, hopefully, consists mainly of Arabs, and it's dentistry. It's a very good profession that is dominated by Israeli Arabs. So no one is stopping anyone, and none of them are violent, and none of them are hateful, because education genuinely just will solve this conflict, and I am positive of it. But Lod was scary, and it was terrifying, and a lot of my friends just had to, like, lock up their parents in their homes and walked out. Like, you know, it's not America. Not everyone has a gun, so it was just really scary. People didn't go to the supermarkets, and yeah, it was just a really, really scary time to live in Israel. And, you know, Lod was never the most tranquil place, but that was just, I don't know how they're going to go back to living in good neighborship ever. I don't know how you go back from that.
And I want to thank you for a great visit here on Too Jewish. And I hope that you do recover from all the stress of the recent war, because I know that you were saying, like, this isn't something you just kind of snap back, everything's fine. And also, I hope you pass that trigonometry exam.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
It's great to talk to you again. Maybe we'll talk again soon. Take care, Chen.
You too. Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be our past Mivinah in Israel, Oshrat Barel, sharing her own experiences of Israel during the Gaza War and her reflections on what might be the best path forward. Our playout this morning comes from the Barcelona Klezmer Gypsy Orchestra, their version of Shalom Aleichem. May there be peace for you. Don't forget, you can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha this Friday night for services and an Oneg Shabbat starting at 6:30 p.m. or Saturday morning at 10 a.m. Just come on in. If you're vaccinated, no masks are required. You can also email me for more information, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, beitsimchatucson.org. And we're signing kids up for religious school. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov. May this be a good week and a week we pray of health and of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.